Come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. And Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Avast, me hearties. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network, WPRPN. Broadcasting today from out of international waters, you've tuned in to episode 54 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host and ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Teaching North Korean refugees, TNKR co-founder Casey Lartigue Jr. joins us this week. Over the course of our pre-recorded 90-minute journey, we navigate a virtual minefield of issues, including hijacked jet airliners, Dennis Rodman, weed in North Korea, the Lazarus effect, flagrant disinformation, cashing in on personal tales of suffering, helping to make a difference, and stories of genuine success. This is the first Korea-themed content we've tackled in a while. While we typically like to take on a broader, more worldly focus, the occasional Asian-based episode is always more than welcome. If you have any innovative and intriguing, largely underreported ROK show ideas or guests, be sure to contact us and let us know. Choosing to enjoy the mild spring weather, we conduct today's interview from the docks of Skullport Harbor. Commerce activity, as always, was brisk down in the area, mostly with ships transferring their contraband cargo and occasional physical altercations, scraps, or even minor brawls breaking out. Hopefully listeners won't find themselves too distracted, but rather manage to capitalize on what nuggets of information we produce over the course of our approximately 90-minute Q&A. Adding a further touch of drama to today's discussion, sparks suddenly fly near the end of the interview when Casey wrestles with the talk's one and only real hardball question. Then again, as English author George Orwell so famously put it, true journalism is publishing what someone doesn't want the world to know. Everything else, mere public relations. We finally managed to connect here with Casey Lartigue Jr. down on the docks of Skullport Harbor. It had been a while to organize things, get everything in place, and bring him on board. I think that's him. Is it Casey? Do we got you there on the other end?
Right, I'm here, live and ready to go.
All right, now the way we usually do things is one of two ways, either head off onto the Robin Hood, or on the other hand, maybe drop by one of the local watering holes that we have down here in Skullport Harbor, the Mossy Wench, the Howling Wolf, or the Scurvy Dog. We could hang out here on the dock. The weather seems to be pretty reasonable and everything, too, I suppose. So I'm not sure the way you want to do things. If we do go on to the Robin Hood, though, I will tell you that you will need a pirate story. So if you're not prepared, even a little pirate story, then...
I have no pirate stories.
None of the refugees coming down from North Korea have had any pirate stories to share with you either,
well,
I guess.
You know, if they have any, the topic hasn't come up, but you know what? Now that I've talked to you, I'm going to ask if they have any next time around.
There's a lengthy pirate history via Japan, a lot of stories about them coming up throughout the Shilla Dynasty and just different eras and periods in the past where they would come inland via the various rivers that Korea has and do all kinds of plundering and looting, all kinds of, well, I guess if you're on the receiving end of getting beat up and raped and robbed, then it's not that great.
I've never been in that position.
Now, your Skype, of course, I'm not sure how you got that set up. If it's like, you run it through your phone or?
Yeah,
or
I'm doing it through my iPad.
Ah, all right. Let's just start then, I guess, by asking you when it was that you first came to Korea. How long have you actually been?
You know, actually, I came on and off a couple of times during the 1990s, and I was teaching English at Yonsei University and also Hanyang University. And I left in 1998, and I went back to the USA, and I started working at a think tank called the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C.
You're a big Penn and Teller fan, then, I would imagine.
Well, actually, I've met both of them in the past at a couple of Cato events. So, yeah, so I worked there for a while, co-edited one book about education policy when I was there, and moved on to a different group called Fight for Children. We raised money for low-income kids in Washington, D.C., and distributed scholarship money. Later on, I hosted a radio talk show on XM 169 The Power, the Casey D'Artigue Show, Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., and a couple of other things, but I stayed in contact with folks in South Korea, and in particular, one of the think tanks here called the Center for Free Enterprise. And then I started working with them over here in South Korea, and then I decided, okay, you know what, I'll stay. And I also worked at another think tank called Freedom Factory. But now I'm at TNKR. It's all volunteer, but this is now my baby, the thing that I'm trying to make something out of it.
Well, before we get too much further into things, I want to hear, and maybe even some of our listeners, a little more about your radio show. How long did that gig carry on for? Sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, first of all, I started as a guest on a show called Mind Your Business. Hosted by a gentleman named Brian Higgins. And Mind Your Business was, don't worry about other people's things. Make sure you take care of your own. But he did it like Mind Your Business also from a business standpoint. And it's kind of a funny show. He would literally read from the one ad sometimes to remind people that you have to take advantage of the opportunities that are out there. He saw me on C-SPAN when I was on one time. He just called me up and asked me if I'd like to become a regular guest on his show. And that's how I started. I was on his show once a week talking about education policy, but lots of other things. And then he was going to go on vacation. And I said, hey, can I co-host your show? And he's like, of course not. And I kept asking. And then finally he said, well, you know what? I'll give you one opportunity to co-host my show. But, you know, don't mess it up. Not his exact words, but don't mess it up, if you can guess. So I co-hosted his show, and then I got the bug. I'm like, you know what? This is something that's fun and easy to do. Can I do it again? He's like, of course not. But, you know, he went on vacation again, and I was, you know, still a regular guest. And then finally, he said, okay, I'll let you co-host twice in a week when he was on vacation. So I started doing that for a little while. I think I did that for about maybe 2 years. And then finally, I talked them into giving me my own show, the Casey D'Artigue Show. My co-host was Elliot Morgan, a good friend of mine. Saturdays on XM, it was a black talk station. It was a live call-in show, and man, oh man, some weeks, as soon as I announced the phone number, the phone lines were lighting up because we're bringing somewhat of a different perspective. It's a mainly progressive talk station. But then we got into a big fight with the producers, and then they kicked us off the air. And so that was the end of that.
You have a little bit of that rebel and pirate spirit in your blood, whether you want to admit it or not, Casey.
My radio career, otherwise just being a guest on different shows.
Well, this is, of course, podcast format, the way that we got things set up here. And I know that
I've done a podcast, by the way.
Oh, you've had your own podcast together. Okay, and that was called the Casey D'Artigue Podcast, or what exactly?
Well, it started off, I was doing it with a North Korean refugee. Her name is Yeonmi Park. She's actually somewhat well-known now. At that time, she was not, in 2014. At first, it was the Casey D'Artigue Show with Yeonmi Park. But she really started to emerge, so it became North Korea Today featuring Casey and Yonmi. And then she became like an international star, and I'm still here.
Right. Well, we got so many areas that we could dive into and explore here at the moment. But I think one of the best places probably is going back to how we've been working on orchestrating, kind of arranging, managing, and getting things set up here to have our little 90-minute discussion. you had some sort of exclusivity. I'm not sure if it's a contract or just a gentleman's agreement, a bit of a handshake kind of deal or what have you. But you did an interview, I guess, with a major Korean television station, maybe KBS, or we couldn't talk until now.
It's going to be on the air probably in about 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
The show, yes. So I can't talk about it.
Oh, well, our show, this is, of course, we're pre-recording here, taking a little different approach than what we typically do because of your schedule. You're this week's guest, and we'll be promoting you, be able to hear what it is that we're discussing here today.
Oh, fantastic.
Come Saturday at noon is when people will get that opportunity. We'll have a slideshow running via YouTube and the whole bit. We've managed to mine out a good deal of your Facebook. It's looking pretty good. So let's get started then, just talking about the North Korean refugee program, in particular the volunteer English end of things. TNKR, of course, is the name of the organization, I guess, that you're, I'm not sure if you'd say the head of necessarily, but definitely influential within and been involved in for how long exactly? How did it all get started and how long you've been involved with TNKR?
Yeah, actually, I'm the co-founder of it, co-founder and now international director of TNKR. The actual organization, first of all, our activity started in March of 2013. But at that time, it was just kind of a friendship thing that we were doing, just introducing refugees to volunteer tutors. But we didn't have like a big plan or anything. We wanted to give the refugees an opportunity to improve their English. Now, there's a bit of a story before that. In 2011, I was helping with a group called Korea International Volunteers. And we were doing just volunteering to help helping South Korean children, mainly low-income children, so that they could improve their English. It's helping them at community centers and places like that. And then I was working as a policy analyst. Sorry, I was working as the director for international relations at the Center for Enterprise, and I was reading about North Korea, but I really had no idea how I could get involved, what I could do, just following the issues. And then I remember just sitting at my desk one day and just saying, you know what? I can do something. I can find my own way. And so I started attending different talks about North Korea. Now, the turning point was in March of 2012, actually March 1st, 2012. There were about 30 North Korean refugees who had been caught in China. And when North Koreans get caught in China, depending on the North Koreans can find out what their plans, they could be tortured, they could be executed, their family members could also receive some brutal treatment. So it's a very serious thing. And about 30 of them were going to be sent back. There have been some demonstrations, and I had taken people to the area right across the street from the Chinese embassy in Seoul to protest. But then I met a South Korean politician named Park Sung-young. She was holding a hunger strike at that time. And I remember just looking at her and saying that, you know what, I'm going to get involved. And not just talking about this, I'm going to get deeply involved. So I talked with her, and a couple of months later, she asked me if I could become the English teacher at a new school she was starting for North Korean children, North Korean refugee children. And I said, no, I'm not a teacher, at least not anymore. But what I can do is I think some of the people that I'm volunteering with Korea International Volunteers, I think some of them might be interested in doing this. So I started recruiting some of them. They joined. And so every Sunday, we would go out to Yeoju, which is about 90 minutes south of Seoul, and teach North Korean refugee children. So I was doing that. And the next thing that happened is that I met Lee Eun-gu, who's the co-founder of TNKR with me. We were talking about how we could work together. And I told her the thing that I was doing at the Moon Mong-cho School. She thought it was great. And then I said, why don't we try the same thing with adults, where we can match up North Korean refugees with volunteer tutors who could then help them improve their English. So we started what we called at first English matching in March of 2013. And we started with, I think it's a 5 North Korean refugees, 5 volunteer tutors, just connecting them and basically saying, good luck. Later on, we started to get more serious about it. We got a lot of attention actually in 2014 because of my work with Yeonmi Park. And then we started developing the organization. I mean, no money or anything, just us doing it on the side as a hobby. But last year, we became an official NGO, And in our history, we've now had 266 North Korean refugees study in our program, and we've had 554 volunteer tutors and coaches help the refugees improve their English and public speaking when they're interested in that.
Oh, that's great. Next question that I was going to ask you just kind of led into things here. You partially answered it, I guess, is how many students do you typically get each year? I think you said this launched or you kind of tackled the things with more of a zeal and a passion back in 2012 when you were protesting outside, I believe was it said you're the right. Chinese embassy, and you said, right. Hey man, there's more that can be done here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to step up to the plate. It's me that's going to help make some change in a positive way here. So, but roughly approximately how many then, let's just do the math, 50 students a year?
Okay. So we've had 266. We've had 54 sessions. Now, the thing is, a lot of the refugees have come back more than once, but we've had 266 people into the program. Some of them come back 2, 3, 4 times during those years to meet with more tutors. What we try to do every month is bring in about 7 to 10 refugees and about 12 to 15 tutors that they can choose from. 2 weeks from now, we're going to have a session at which we have 7 North Korean refugees who want to engage in public speaking. That'll be on April 1st and 2nd. So we'll have about 7 refugees and about 11 or 12 coaches they can choose from. And we encourage the coaches to be willing to accept at least 1 or 2 refugees that they can then help improve their public speaking ability. Then next month on April 22nd and 23rd, we're going to have a session where we'll have refugees who just want to improve their English. At that one, we hope to have about 10 refugees and about 16 tutors. And so if you do the math, if each tutor agrees to take 2 refugees, that'll mean 32 learning opportunities for the refugees. And the refugees can choose from, you know, several different tutors and then start working with 3 or 4 people to improve their English.
What sort of investment does it require or is asked from on the part of the tutors coming to the program and becoming engaged and wanting to be a part of the program? Is it a couple hours a week or something like that usually?
Okay. Yeah. So what we tell the tutors is at a minimum, be willing to come in, take 1 refugee, study with that refugee at least twice a month, 90 minutes each session. That's the bare minimum. Now, we hope they'll be willing to accept 2 refugees, that then they will meet each of them separately twice a month, which would mean pretty much either once a week, or they could have 1 week where they meet 2 refugees and then take a week off. And then next week they could take 2 refugees and study with them. So at a minimum, 3 hours a month at a minimum. But, you know, obviously we hope 6.
All right.
Now, that's the minimum. We have some who once they get in, they just go crazy and they'll start meeting with each refugee once a week, sometimes twice a week. We had one pair, they were meeting 3 times a week for like 3 months. And we have some refugees who are really eager. One of them last month had 20 one-to-one sessions with his tutors, which is about 34 hours, something like that. And we had one tutor last month. He had 13 one-to-one sessions with the refugees that he's tutoring. So those are obviously the outliers. But at a minimum, we just say 3 hours a month.
There's, I guess, a bit of a range as far as the ages are concerned from the standpoint of the students, their end of things. Have there been, but I've looked at some of the pictures that you've got on Facebook. It looks like there's some perhaps university age level students. Has there potentially been any romances or matchmaking kind of blossoming and taking place here? And
as I tell the tutors, over your dead body, that will happen. Not over my dead body, over her dead body. Okay, we make it clear that this is not some dating opportunity,
right.
Not a hangout opportunity. I'm not a powerful person, but all the power I have, I will use to destroy you. So don't even think about it. Don't come into this program treating it as some opportunity. Now, dating is fine. You know, I'm not against it and all that, but within this program, it's not allowed.
Wait till you've concluded your formal the teaching end of things, and history is kind of, you know, things have moved on.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we make it clear, no dating here, and we're in all the conversations with the tutors and coaches. We do our best to monitor. We make it clear that you have the potential to destroy this program by doing anything like that. So just don't do it. This is not the place.
Where do the lessons occur and take place then? Do you have a special meeting place then where everyone gathers, or it's not done at somebody's like a private residences or anything like that?
No, so the way we do it, so number one, we have a small office, but we cannot accommodate that many people per week. Now, last month we had seven sessions per day. So 28 days, we had 201 sessions during the month. So we cannot accommodate them at our office. Number one, they meet at study rooms. Number two, cafes. Number three, some of the refugees are students. Some of the tutors are professors. In that case, they'll usually be able to find a classroom at the university. And then number four, I mean, we have some, they don't want to pay for coffee at a cafe, you know, park bench, depending on the weather. And then worst case scenario, same gender. It's okay to meet at each other's homes, but we say not for at least a month or so. First, just get to know each other, and it should be the refugee who informs us that they would like to do that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So we're flexible about the places. Some of them have found some really cheap choices for study rooms. I mean, there's one place I couldn't believe it. They said it was 500 won per hour, which, you know, so 1,000 won for 2 hours for them to book the study room to study at. So it's not expensive in some cases, but, you know, most people just go to a coffee shop, 10,000 won for two people to study at. Now, that's for track one, which is the English study part of our program. But track two, we strongly encourage the coaches and the refugees to meet at a place, either at our office or at a study room because the refugees might be discussing some sensitive topics, some things from their past. That's not the kind of thing to be talking about in a coffee shop with a bunch of strangers. Some of them might be trying to listen in.
CCTV cameras every 5 feet. Yeah, that's
right. Right. So, and then the other thing is that we want them to have actual opportunities. That means stand up and practice. You stand up and practice in a cafe. Yeah. I think there's some riot is about to start.
So role play, action.
So we tell them come to our office or just find a place where it's actually comfortable for actual opportunity to stand up and practice, and also they can talk about things confidentially.
Well, and what sort of things would they be discussing then confidentially? And on top of that, I was going to kind of maybe we can add to that this business of adjustment, of course, because it's got to be a bit of a – it can't be the easiest thing in the world, of course, coming from North Korea and making that transition. I know it's widely – reported and, you know, discussed how it's not easy, of course. It can often, sometimes you've got refugees that actually end up returning to North Korea, believe it or not. At least that's what I've heard.
The numbers, about 30,000 North Korean refugees have come to South Korea since, I think 1997 or 1998 is when they count like the modern generation of people. And so within 30,000 people, you can always find whatever kind of thing you're looking for, obviously. So some refugees have had no problem adjusting. I would say more of them have had problems adjusting. And then, as you said, some have just returned. The best number that I've seen, actually in Andrei Lenkov's book, The Real North Korea, he says that about 100 North Korean refugees have been known to have returned. The thing that's important to note about that is that, I mean, obviously the media will present that, you know, the refugees and, you know, running to freedom and all the kind of thing. Some people who have escaped were not looking for freedom. I mean, in some cases, they followed a parent. Other cases, they followed like a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a spouse, or they had some reason they had to leave and maybe later it was okay to come back. People should keep in mind that North Korea is not your middle class neighborhood in Virginia or whatever. A lot of things are going on when people make the decisions to escape. And then when you talk about them returning, I'll give you a quick case, quick example. This person did not return, but just the thought process that goes in that we might not think about. So last year, my grandmother's sister passed away in March. The same day, one of the refugees in our program, her grandmother passed away. So we're talking and say, wow, this is terrible. Now, in my case, I was able to fly back to Texas and to be with my relatives. I had that option. In her case, she couldn't talk to her actually, she made a phone call to North Korea, very brief, of course, and they had to plan it out. She and her mother and sister, who all escaped, they're like, wow, we can't go back. We can't do anything. We can't be with our loved ones at this time. The North Koreans, when they leave, North Korea has made it an all or nothing decision. That if you leave this country, you cannot come back. And if we find out that you left and we catch you, you know, we'll, whatever, torture you or kill you. And then your family members will be in trouble too. So it's an all or nothing decision. And so sometimes people, yeah, they might have some reasons that, okay, maybe I need to go back. In some cases, some of the people have had their family members threatened and that if so-and-so doesn't come back, you'll be all killed. So I'm just saying there are lots of calculations. So when people talk about that handful of North Koreans who've escaped, okay, about 100 that we know of have returned, about 30,000 have come the opposite way. And there are lots of things that are going on with lots of people, so many different situations. So, you know, it's a complex thing. It's not such a simple thing as, wow, I can't believe they went back.
Right. And I'm sure, too, that when somebody does leave North Korea, it doesn't make it any easier for the family that they've left back in the DPRK that I'm guessing it suddenly becomes much more on the, you know, on Pyongyang's radar. Taking
fact,
a closer look. It's like, maybe these are subversive types, too. We better pay a little closer attention to what's going on here.
You nailed it. You nailed it, absolutely. In fact, one of the refugees, she told the story that after her mother escaped, their whole family was under surveillance. She's considered to be a traitor because her mother left. She basically has no opportunity for her life in North Korea after that because it's hard to get a job, hard to advance in any way. And then they're just considered like the lowest of the low. So, yeah, so there's definitely some you know, ramifications in addition to being at risk of being tortured or executed.
I wasn't planning on really getting too heavily into the political end of things at this particular stage. Usually you save the kind of hardball, kind of heavier topics for the end of the conversation. And maybe you can figure out why that's the case. We'll see. Hopefully things, you know, hopefully it all works out in the end here without too many problems. Peter Daly, here's a name I'm going to throw it at you. And the reason I'm doing this is because I think I saw him in one of your pictures on Facebook.
Peter actually joined our program for the first time in September 2014. And he tutored one refugee and then he returned in 2015. I believe that time as a speech coach in our program. So he's been with us consistently, definitely since 2015, but he's been a part of our program. Now, you know, Peter is accomplished in his own right, as far as being the man chasing the cults in South Korea.
We had him on the show.
I heard the show.
22. Yeah. Awesome.
I heard the show when he was on it. Sure. Yes. He's been in our program for quite a while.
Well, that's great. And he's quite a character, too. I haven't met him in person yet, but I think you'd be a fun guy to maybe hang out with and spend a little time with him. Maybe have a beer.
And actually, just one more thing I'll mention about Peter. Peter, there's also a website called bringmyfatherhome.org.
Yes, right.
Yeah. And Peter is the web content. I forgot the exact title, but like web content person for that website. And this is the case of a South Korean man whose father was on a South Korean airplane that was hijacked to North Korea in 1969. Peter is part of Mr. Hwang, his father's Hwang Won. Peter is part of the team that has been trying to raise awareness for that case.
Okay, so there we go. A little foggy on the details there. I was confusing that plane with a flight, I think it was, how is this for coincidence, 007? Was that back in the mid-1980s?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the one that the plane was blown up. And two of the North Koreans were caught, and then one of them committed suicide by swallowing some poison. And the other one tried to, but she did not. And I think her name was Kim Kyung-hee. I think that was her name. And she wrote a book called The Tears of My Soul. Yeah, and she's actually now in South Korea. I think she married a South Korean or something like that. But yeah, she's been here. She, you know, repudiated what she did, and she's been here, living here happily since then, but I'm sure under guard.
You've kind of, I'm not too up to speed on the whole incident. How were, what, they planted bombs on the plane and then it took off and
Yeah, but they got caught later on. But those are two different cases. So
Yes. 1969 hijacked and commandeered and redirected into North Korea, Pyongyang, I would imagine. And so let's get a little more then, and just quickly with the 007 incident, that was here in the show notes, is one of the things I had seen, you know, Bring My Father Home. Mm-hmm. We'll add that later too as well, so people can easily follow the links. I'm not sure if it's best to refer to as a pet project. It's something that I think that you're really kind of pushing for. And as you say, Peter as well, I think I've heard about this from both you. So definitely something worth getting behind and helping to let more people know about.
One of our projects is called How to Help North Koreans. What we do is that we have North Korean refugees or other people who have special connections with North Korea. They can come to us and we'll hold an occasional session in which they talk about the project they want to launch. And then volunteers can join those different projects. So the one with Bring My Father Home, that's one of the projects within TNKR, within our How to Help North Koreans project. So people who are interested, they will be able to join up with that project and to help Mr. Hwang advocate for having his father return from North Korea. They can do things such as social media. They can help Peter with his website as far as adding content to it, organize events. So they can be as creative as they want.
Is his father still alive? And on top of that, how many people were actually kidnapped?
So there were 50 people on the airplane, including the crew, December 1969. There were 50 people on it. They were all taken to North Korea. There was a North Korean sleeper agent who, you know, hijacked the plane. They got to North Korea, and obviously they do the same thing they do, beat them up a little, interrogate them, and all that kind of thing. There were protests in South Korea, and eventually North Korea did send 39 of the people back, but 11 of them were kept behind. What the North Korean government has said is that they want to be here. Obviously, people did lobby, they campaigned, but, you know, now it's been 47 years, so people are not as interested as they were back then. With Mr. Hwang's case, he did receive a report a couple of years ago through whatever behind the scenes kind of thing that his father was still alive. That was 3 years ago, and now his father would be 79 years old, you know, assuming that he's still alive.
This dovetails actually into the whole business. I think I mentioned it to you in one of our prior text message exchanges. The POWs and MIAs from not just the Korean War era, but also Vietnam. A lot of people don't know this, but supposedly a lot of these American soldiers that went missing, they ended up in all places, if you can imagine this, North Korea is where they're quietly, you know, they're secreted off to. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I've heard about it. In fact, there was one, I think he wrote a book a couple of years ago about being in North Korea, and I guess he changed his mind later on. He actually wanted to go to North Korea, but after a while, it wasn't such a good life, but he couldn't leave. And I forgot the circumstances of him returning, though, but I believe after he was finally set free that he did write a book about his experience.
Apparently, this is where we find the terms brainwashing and Manchurian candidate originating from the North Korean experience. I think during the Korean War era, in fact, because there was a lot of funny things that went on. People, soldiers taken hostage. Who knows the sort of things that go on in these camps, the work camps, concentration camps, and the, you know, these endless mind games and the torture, physical, but also mental, of course, too, that you end up becoming a whole new person, I guess.
Sure. A lot of things happen. But you know what? Actually, a couple of years ago, I had an exchange with a black man who was a defender of the Confederacy.
Oh, yeah. How about that?
Okay. Well, so look, people can believe almost anything.
And we pirates as libertarians, quite a reputation as libertarians, you know, whatever you want to believe, you fly right at it. Just don't mess with us, you know, just don't be careful not to cross that line. So we can all live together in peace and harmony and not a problem. A lot of black African-American folks also voted for Trump, even though supposedly the media told us he's such a big racist. But I really think this is a bit of a side issue, but frankly, to be quite honest, I just think he just looks for the best people. He doesn't care that if you're gay or whatever either. That's nonsense too. He's had a lot of gay people work for him over the years, I'm pretty sure, as well as all kinds of backgrounds, Hispanic or what have you. Getting off on a bit of a tangent. Maybe, hey, one day he'll have one of your students work for him. Who knows? You know, how about that? Speaking of which, Dennis Rodman. I'm not sure if you're a basketball fan or not. He hasn't been back for a couple of years now, but it was a pretty high profile visit a few years ago. Did you follow that at all, or what were your thoughts?
Okay, I'm also a columnist with the Korea Times, and I wrote a column about that Rodman case, and I did not criticize him for going. My point in my column was that he should have come to South Korea and met with some of the people who had escaped from North Korea, that he would have had a better perspective on things, talking to refugees. So he went to one half, got half of the story, and then went back saying that this guy, you know, this dictator was his friend. And by the way, I'm a basketball fan. I was a basketball sports reporter back when I was in college. So, yes, I follow things, and including Dennis Rodman. But anyway, that was my point about him.
That's a great point. We haven't really heard too much from him the last little while, although one of the things that was widely publicized in the news media at the time, I'm not sure if it was it made it into outlets such as Fox or CNN. I read it via one of the online newspapers, but that Dennis, of course, has became quite intoxicated and actually made a bit of a scene out in the hallway of the hotel where he was staying, literally peeing and defecating in his pants. This is a story I heard. No idea. It just could be total propaganda. You know.
Yeah, well, my thing is, I'm just surprised anyone pays attention to anything Dennis Rodman does off the basketball.
Oh, geez. Amazing. Yeah, well, we'll come back to that. It's a related issue regarding the North and different issues and so forth as we kind of, in the last maybe 15, 20 minutes of our discussion. Mm-hmm. You're going to be good for the full 90-minute segment.
I'm
looking at the time here. It's about, what have we been going for, about 35, almost 40 minutes now, not quite. But once again, just to remind listeners, this is not your typical standard weekly production of Pirate Radio Podcast. Pirate Larry is not available at the moment. We've just kind of had to do things spur of the moment. You're listening to a pre-recorded show, folks, just to be clear, with Casey Lartig Jr. out of Seoul, South Korea. We're discussing the matter, a number of related matters concerning North Korean refugees coming to the South, learning English, making the transition to the ROK in learning about the South, culture, people, history, and so on and so forth. How difficult do they find it to transition? We've talked about that a little bit, of course. Speaking of brainwashing, North Korea being quite notorious for this, how much are the North Koreans, while they're living there, actually just putting on a show and putting on a brave face and going along with the wishes of the dear leader and more or less, you know, falling into line with the over-the-top, exuberant clapping and wailing and crying, saturated emotions?
It's hard to answer that question, obviously. You know, I'm not there. But a couple of things I've heard. Number one, when you look at the scenes of the North Koreans crying and all that, keep in mind the system of songbun in the country, where they classify people into three different main groups. I mean, there's lots of subgroups and all that, too. But, you know, at the top are the people who are close to the regime. Then there are the people in the middle who, I guess they call them suspect. And then the ones at the bottom who are the spies. If you want to stay in the top class, then there are things that you need to do. I think that's more important than the actual brainwashing. I know obviously that interests people in the West, but the actual incentive is to keep your place in that society, to keep yourselves in the good class. And so I've talked to some people who said that they had to pretend that they were crying. And a couple of them, they, you know, would have to poke themselves in the eye to try to make themselves cry.
Oh, jeez.
So it's hard to, you know, obviously it's hard to know. But obviously one thing that's true is they have to keep the gates up to keep people from leaving. So if they believe in it, then they wouldn't have to have shoot the kill guards at the border to keep people in. If North Koreans in that country truly believe that the leaders were so invincible. So I think that's the biggest test about what they believe. the fact that they must be kept in under the threat of death.
Most obvious indicator, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, but as far as adjusting, I'll mention a couple of things. So North Koreans who come to South Korea, obviously there are a bunch of issues. And again, when you talk about 30,000 people, it's hard to just come up with like one or two explanations about their adjustment. And different people adjust in different ways, just like among people around the world. I mean, people go to a new place. A lot of people have adjustment problems. That's why you have this whole idea of culture shock, because some people just aren't ready to travel. And it turns out that old saying, there's no place like home, that's really true for lots of people. That's where they should be, because they have trouble adjusting. But when you talk about North Korean refugees, I'm not going to try to talk about all of them, but I'll talk about the ones who, let's think about it this way, the ones who've actually gotten into college. A lot of North Korean refugees drop out. And one reason is not about just like not getting along with people or having trouble with the society, but 32% of them say they drop out because of English. Another 28% say they drop out because they need to make a living. And then there's another 12% or so who say they drop out because they have trouble keeping up in their classes. And because obviously the South Korean system is really competitive, and for lots of them, they are not required to go through the same application process that South Koreans do. South Koreans have to take the exams in order to get in. At many of the universities, not all of them, but at many universities, they just have to go through an interview in order to get in. So a lot of them end up overmatched at the universities that they get into, and so a lot of them end up struggling with that. I think that's a bigger thing. Now, obviously, you're talking about people who've adjusted enough to apply to a university and to get accepted. If you start talking about the people who are working in factories, they have a whole different list of concerns because, you know, they're working 12 to 15 hours a day in bad circumstances. And according to one statistic I saw in the news, and again, can't believe everything you read, but they said that about 80% of North Korean refugees who are employed in menial labor, hard labor. And then the income levels are about 50% of South Koreans. And again, different statistics and different surveys and all that. But about 35% of North Korean refugees are unemployed. Those are some, I think, bigger issues when you talk about adjustment. Just being able to make a living comes before, you know, do I have friends in my neighborhood and, you know, are people nice to me?
Absolutely. What do they call those jobs here in South Korea where they...
The 3Ds.
Dangerous.
What's the last one? Dirty, yeah. Dangerous.
You know, I always forget the last one too. It's like dirty, dumb, and dangerous or something like that. Like, I have no idea. Like
the jobs that South Koreans don't want, and, you know, they'll import people from the Philippines and other places. So
Middle East or Pakistan, and you name it. A related question kind of maybe dovetails a little bit into what we've been discussing just up to this point here in the last few minutes. Well, in the North, they do learn English, do they not?
Sure, they do. But the thing is, there's been a change. So up through the 1980s and then part of the 1990s, the second language was Russian. With the fall of the Soviet Union having less, being of less importance before for North Koreans, actually English became a little more common. But let's keep it within the context of very few native speakers there, number one. And that number two, the people who are teaching are not really qualified to teach. Actually, I think I mentioned, or maybe I did not, that this Saturday I'll be speaking, well, it'll be after the show is on, but speaking at the Kultisol conference with a North Korean refugee who was an English teacher in North Korea. She is afraid to death to speak English to people because her English is at a low level. And as soon as she says that she was an English teacher in North Korea, people have high expectations. But I guess she just taught grammar. It's a case of, you know, she's the one with one eye and everybody else is blind. She knew more English than the others when she applied to go to the university. She was not looking to teach English, but she happened to get a good score. So then, guess what? You're an English teacher now. So, yeah, now English is becoming a little more common than it was before. But just keep in mind that they're more likely to actually study British English compared to American English, because America is still the hated enemy in North Korea.
Yeah, you notice that with the accents I've heard, at least, the way I can't replicate it very well myself. I'm not even going to try and make a total fool of myself, more of a fool of myself than I already am. So it's interesting, listening to the way that they enunciate and so forth. So one of the things I find just here in the South, too, is that everything is, it's on elephant, on Apple. Would you like on Apple? On. It's like, what is this? And they all do it. And as a native speaker, I have to correct them and say, well, you can, I guess, maybe do it that way, but really let's take another approach here. It's and it's got the vowel straight. So,
yeah,
so
sure. Much. Now, one thing I'll say is that now, even though they do learn English now in North Korea at a higher level than they did before, we still have to keep in mind that people among the elite are more likely to have better English teachers, more educated.
Funny how that works. Exactly.
Huh? And then the people who are out in the countryside, they probably don't have English because they probably don't even have an English teacher there. And then second, when they come to us here at TNKR, we actually have had several North Korean refugees who were at the ABC level when they came to us, as in they had just learned the ABCs.
Sure.
We have a few others who I say they're at the DEF level, so they've gotten a little past ABCs, but, you know, still they don't know much. The ones who've been here for a short time, typically they are at a really low level, a much lower level than South Korean peers at their ages and even at their education levels. They still will be far behind because obviously the South Koreans, even if they have trouble with some of the pronunciation, as you mentioned, or if they have trouble with speaking, you know, they still can understand quite a bit of what you say. And if you write it down, they can usually figure it out. But for a lot of the North Korean refugees, they're not at that point. So what I like to say is think about the North Korean refugees being at the level of South Koreans probably about 40, 50 years ago in English, before there were many native speakers here to teach. I mean, the level obviously was much lower at that time. But now, you know, plenty of native English speakers here and interaction with the outside world. So their levels are going to be much higher here.
Should give listeners a little better sense of perspective then. And just to be clear, we should have, of course, addressed this earlier, but TNKR, that's Teaching North Koreans, isn't it?
It's Teach North Korean Refugees, and we couldn't come up with a vowel. So TNKR, and some of the students stumble over it, KNTR, TKRE, or whatever. So, yeah, TNKR has two parts to it. We call it Track 1, which is finding my own way. Our approach is that the refugees should look at our program as a self-study opportunity. We encourage them to study at other places, at language institutes, universities, like the British Council has a special program for refugees. Pagoda Language Institute offers like a 90% discount for refugees to study at. So there are lots of opportunities out there, especially a lot of group classes. But they can come to us because they have the opportunity to study one-to-one with fluent and native English speakers who can help them. But we expect them to come to class prepared with something. Don't just come to the class saying, oh, the teacher would just teach me. So this is more of we'll meet you halfway, that we'll find a tutor. But you need to come to class prepared with something. You know, it's like a guide for the tutors. I tutored a student recently. There was a miscommunication with her, with the refugee's tutor that day. So, you know, I sit down with her and say, well, what should I teach you? She already has something ready. She's like, today I want to study airport English. Suddenly we're doing airport English.
Great.
So when the refugees come prepared, obviously it can be a better learning situation because the tutors, they're not just trying to figure this person out, which is why actually a lot of the tutors in our program love it because, you know, some of them are teaching now, like in the South Korean schools, teaching children, and they're used to the children, no teacher, no teacher, no, let's play game, teacher. No English today, teacher. But with the refugees in our program, they're locked in. I mean, they want to learn. They're extremely motivated. And for some of them, this is their shot to learn English. So we have track one of our program. You know, we're always looking for tutors who can join up with us. And then track two is the part of the program for those refugees who want to tell their stories, who want to engage in public speaking, or they might want to write a book, or they have some aspirations about communicating with people, not just in English, but with some type of goal. So that part of what we're doing is called track two. The little tagline for that one is telling my own story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, before we get carried along here too far, maybe now's a good time to get your phone number out there and contact information. The number that I've got here via Facebook, the office number is 070-400-6-0942.
That's right. Right here on my desk. I answer the phone.
There you go. The subway information, how to get there, I guess. It says you're located near Kwang Hung Chang.
Yes, Kwang Hung Chang Station is on line number 6, 2 stops from Hapjeong, and 6 stops from Itaewon.
Okay, well, so yes. People that are obviously living in Seoul, many of them will be familiar with how that all kind of, how that works. Myself, I'm more based out of the central part of the country. Today, of course, we are broadcasting, as always, from international waters. Yar, yar, yar. So, all those pirates, I tell ya.
What I recommend to people before calling is to check into us a bit. So, our website is teachnorthkoreanrefugees.org. So, the full name, teachnorthkoreanrefugees.org. And if they click the link at the top that says volunteer, there are the options that they can fill out a form to sign up and to let us know which part of the program they would like to join. So they can join either for English tutoring, which is track 1 or track 2, or they can sign up as general volunteers. Now, just to be clear, we prefer to have tutors and coaches who are in the area for face-to-face meetings. Now, for general volunteers, you can be anywhere in the world. You can be anywhere in South Korea, and you can help. So in that case, social media, marketing, fundraising, writing, editing, doing this kind of podcast. So whatever it is that is your particular skill, we just say to people, please communicate that to us. I've got a stump speech that I give when I go out and talk, especially to young people. And one of the first questions that I say that I hate from volunteers, potential volunteers, is when they ask, how can I help? It's a great question, but the issue is that I'm not a mind reader. I can't look at you and figure out what it is you can do. If your name is Bill Gates, I want you to give money. If you speak 4 languages, you can engage in translation. If you're great at like web design, then you can help us with that. Think about what it is that you can do, and please communicate that to us. Don't make it into like a guessing game where I need to figure out how you can add to the organization. The second thing I'd say is that please make a commitment. Now, you can decide your level of commitment, but you need to communicate that. I've been involved in volunteer activities for about 15 years now. And one thing I see is that lots of people, they want to help one time, and then they're done. They don't realize that it's something that's ongoing. When I was helping at the Mulmongcho School, 1 week we would have like 14 volunteers show up. The next week, 2. The next week, 7. So it was hard for us to plan when people would not commit. A great way that you can help an organization is by letting them know the level of commitment. Now, sometimes people will complain that, not to us, but to other, about other organizations that, I sent them an email, they never answered. I try to tell such people that, the reason some organizations don't answer is they've got lots of drive-by volunteers who just send an email, and then, you know, people will respond. It happens to me. I'll respond. And then those people seem to go into hiding where they don't check their emails or anything for like a week. And then they send a message and say, I've been busy. I couldn't check your email. But now I'd like to, communicate with you. Or they'll take like a month or two to respond. So I tell people, if you've got your level of commitment, express that and then stay in touch. Don't just disappear. Then the last thing is figure out your role and then get involved. Don't just wait for us to tell you what you need to do. Study us, figure out your particular role, and then just do it. If you're someone that you don't have a particular skill, at least you think so, and you're not sure how to get involved, there's always one way to help every organization out there. Can you guess?
Money?
Yes, absolutely.
Ding, 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 ding.
Exactly. There's always one way you can help any organization, especially NGO, and that is either donate, and if you don't want to donate, you can fundraise for an organization, and they will always love you for that, because lots of people will say, I'm already volunteering. Why should I try to raise money for you, too? But for an organization to grow, they need people who can also fundraise, because you take some of the pressure off the people in charge.
A lot of great points that you've laid out there, of course, including keeping those channels of communication open and trying to be as clear as you can what your intention and purpose is in getting involved with the operation. So speaking of fundraisers, well, I think it was last year. In fact, you had a marathon that you put together.
Yeah. We have some creative volunteers who come up with different ways to raise money. I'm not sure which one you saw, but one of them named Tom O'Connor had a fundraiser for us. He ran, and I think actually a marathon to North Korea. I think that's what he did. Wow, I'm not sure now. But yes, we've had marathons. We had a volunteer. His name is Bashir Muhammad. He rode on his bicycle from Busan to Incheon, which is, it is 633 kilometers. And his goal was to raise $1 Canadian for each kilometer that he rode. And he actually hit his target. Now I did tell him, you know, by the way, you can do that round trip. You know, you can also. but we've also had some volunteers who are into yoga. And one of them, her name is Taylor Beattie. She's the one who came to us with this idea that she would teach yoga and then she would do fundraising at that. We have another one. Her name is Jennifer. She also did the same thing. And then we have a volunteer who actually was with us just for a short time. Her name is Julie, and she went back to the USA, and then she held a Zumbathon at her university, Gettysburg College.
Zumba being what exactly?
Like sports dance kind of thing. Just, you know, ladies, mainly ladies. I hope nobody gets angry at me, but
shake it, baby. Don't break it.
So mainly ladies dancing around to get into shape. So what we tell the volunteers is if you have a creative idea, just talk to us about it and, you know, we might be able to do it. I mean, we have a website now is give.teachnorthkoreanrefugees.org. So give.teachnorthkoreanrefugees.org. One of our volunteers, his name is Daniel. He's been with us actually since late 2015. And something he did on his Facebook page, he said that if you donate to TNKR, then you can tell me which kind of hot, spicy Korean food to eat, and I'll eat it. And he ended up raising like 300,000 won, so, you know, almost about $300. We have another volunteer right now. His name is Tony, and what he's doing is if people abroad will donate at least 10,000 won, he will send them some of those little cute Korean stickers. When he told me, actually he's a professor, teaches communication at the University of Wisconsin, but he's in South Korea now. He's raised 300,000 won. I mean, when he told me, I'm like, no one's going to do that. But 300,000 won later, I'm like, hey, that's a great idea. And then we have another volunteer. Her name is Hannah. Thing that she's doing, she's sewing like little sweaters for people if they would donate at least 10,000 won to TNKR. So yeah, so we have a lot of volunteers who are coming up with these different ideas. So yeah, people who want to help, you can always come up with other ways. And we also have, by the way, 4 North Korean refugees in our program who also have set up fundraisers and inviting people. Now, for them, the idea of civil society and helping other people and raising money for strangers, I mean, it's a completely foreign concept to the refugees, but they join our program. And so many of them said that they were inspired by the tutors in our program, that they were willing to give so much of their time to help them. And actually, my co-director, I mentioned earlier, Lee Eun-gu, she's South Korean. And she also talked about the way she got inspired by just seeing so many volunteers willing to come and give so much of their time to help North Korean refugees improve themselves and to have a better chance in life. And actually, I want to tell you a very quick story about one of the refugees in our program. She is someone who was really moved by the volunteers. Now, I cannot say her name, but she came to our program. We have a waiting list now, you know, really popular among refugees. She wanted to study in our program, but as we told her, you know, you're on a waiting list. And she says, please, can I just come to the orientation? Because, you know, we have an orientation before the session where the refugees choose their tutors. So we told her there's no space for you, but if you really want to come, we'll let you come. Then she came to the orientation, and she's just like, oh, I really want to study. Then we had the matching session. That's where the refugees choose their tutors. And again, she's like, can I just come to the matching session? And we're like, no, it's not really the kind of thing we do. But then the night before the matching session, you know, almost like a Hollywood movie, one of the other refugees canceled. So then we told her, because you went to the orientation, we can let you into the session. So she comes to the session, chooses five teachers. After we, you know, we're wrapping up the session, and she just says that 3 years ago, she actually tried to commit suicide. What had happened is that she had told some idiot South Korean reporter too much information about her family because, you know, they were in the middle of their escape. They ended up getting caught and sent back to North Korea. Some of them got executed and some of them just got tortured. So she felt that it was her fault. Could have just been the greatest coincidence, you know, but she was sure that it was her fault because the reporter had reported on her family. And she said, looking around the room at all these lovely teachers willing to help her, that she just was so happy she did not commit suicide because she could not have been here to be able to choose teachers. And then so she joined us on October 1st of last year, and she had 25 one-to-one sessions in the 2 months after that, just studying intensively because she was at that not quite ABC but DEF level. So, yeah, so we have a lot of just great volunteers who join us, and the refugees really appreciate it so much.
As one would hope and imagine, of course. So I think one of the things that you're emphasizing here, though, just, you know, backing things up, looking more at the fundraising end of things, is that people are able to get as creative and adventurous, I suppose, and imaginative, just using their skill sets and abilities that they have already in place and drawing upon those to make a little magic happen, really.
I just say, number one, keep it legal. And number two, just let me know what you're going to do. I mean, I don't want to go online and say, what? Wait, no, that's not what I meant by creative.
Right, so, right. Yeah,
let's try to. Just be in touch with me. Let me know what you want to do. But 99% of the time, I'm sure I'm going to say, oh, yeah, let's get it started. You know, always. Don't just talk to me about it. Just get it started.
Got to keep those channels of communication open. Speaking of getting it started, I'm not sure if you saw or not, but I just shared with you a link to our web domain, WPRPN. That's the World Pirate Radio Podcast Network, of course, .com/TNKR. Where does that go?
Oh, you mean Facebook?
No. Just to make it a little easier for you here, I just shared it in the chat that we're actually having here with Valkyrie. They're holding down the technical end of things, so doing a great job.
Okay, I see. The link is under the other one. So, okay. Okay, loading it up right now. And let's see. Oh, it says page cannot be found.
Right. Yeah, it's waiting to be built.
Oh,
Are you good with WordPress?
No, I'm not.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you find somebody who is, be our guest and feel free to
put a bit
of a blog together, some links redirecting to your other main pages and all of that sort of thing. It's something that we're offering all of our guests to basically, they've got a presence online here via our main web domain. So, but let's quickly transition now. We're running out of time and I want to get a little more hardball with you here. We got to just quickly, let's just hit on these maybe a couple minutes with each one. The missile issues, of course, looming large in the news these days. I frankly don't pay much attention. We haven't watched television here in well over 5 years. It's just a lot of it so depressing, of course, and a waste of time. But, you know, there's a lot that does come out via the web, of course. We can leave that aside for now. It's not even really applicable to what we're doing today. We're not adverse to talking about it, but just not for today's discussion. Although Kim Jong-nam, we could go there. I felt quite bad for the guy, obviously. I didn't realize he's got a couple sons. There's the price of a human life these days, and some at even as high a stature as him, $90 to have this kind of, I'm not even sure if she, something of a Manchurian candidate almost. She thought, one of the assassins at least thought that they were in some kind of prank reality show, which to me indicates that she might have actually been hypnotized to do what she did.
Yeah, and I have no idea about that. But I'll say this, I've talked to some folks, including some refugees. Some of them said that they were not surprised that he was killed. They just didn't know why it happened at this particular time.
They'd probably been following him for a while. They saw and seized the opportunity. He let his guard down there for a moment, and boom, there you go.
Yes, exactly. So, well, that's just it. He was not in a position to let his guard down. I mean, after seeing what happened to his uncle, I mean, he should have already known that he could be next on the list.
What happened to his uncle? I have no idea.
Oh, what's Jong Song-taek? Jong Song-taek? One of his uncles, I guess I'll say, was actually someone really influential and early on was thought to be like his advisor, but he had him killed a couple of years ago.
Oh, Kim Jong-un's advisor.
Kim Jong-un. I mean, I guess that's his uncle also, since they're half brothers.
It would have probably, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm saying after seeing his uncle killed by his half brother, he should have known he cannot let his guard down, is my point.
Are you familiar at all with the Lazarus effect?
Not at all. I don't know what that is.
Oh, my. Well, here we go. Because the deal is, and it is for people that do study North Korean affairs, many will be familiar with the idea of how Kim Jong-un had purportedly killed generals and relatives and girlfriends and all these things, which just then miraculously happened to reappear a couple months down the road for some reason. So that sort of thing, for me at least, and a lot of others, I'm sure, too, leaves them with their scratching their heads, asking themselves, well, wait a minute. It was widely reported that he had committed these heinous and vicious atrocities, but then these personalities suddenly find themselves, you know, as this, the story of Lazarus from out of the Bible, rising from the dead.
You're right. I didn't know what your particular angle. Okay, yeah, I got it now. So as I said, I'm a columnist with the Korea Times, and one of my colleagues is Don Kirk. And he just wrote a column recently where he said that you can't really trust any reporting that comes out of North Korea or about North Korea. I'm one of those people. I don't bother following the day to day. This person's missing. This person hasn't appeared in public for months. Oh, this person is back. Because the thing to realize is that the killing machine of North Korea continues to operate anyway. It doesn't matter if a particular person is missing. Even a couple of years ago, Kim Jong-un was missing for a couple of months. And then the media is all in a tizzy. Where's Kim Jong-un? Oh, where's the dictator? You know what? The killing machine was continuing. My thing about Kim Jong-un, after he took power, I guess early 2012, after his father died, and then it became clear he would be the leader, a lot of people were optimistic that, oh, well, he studied in Switzerland. You know, he'll be willing to open North Korea up. And I was on a radio show, I guess TBS EFM, I was on a radio show, and they asked me what I thought about it. And I said, I think he's going to be worse than his father.
Yeah, most Asian dictators have been educated in the West.
Yes, but the thing is that people would thought that he might be the one willing to open. But you have to recognize the incentives in the system that he's in. If you're the head of KFC, you're still going to kill chicken. If you're the head of the mafia, you're still going to engage in crime. If you're the head of the North Korean government, you're still going to kill and extort from North Koreans. So I didn't see any reason to be optimistic that he was going to be any different, except that he might be as brutal as his grandfather was back in the 1950s when he also had to consolidate his power.
Mm-hmm. So what do you say?
I don't really pay attention to the day-to-day stuff about North Korea because, again, I mean, since this guy took power – I don't know if you follow the numbers of refugees who've been escaping, but as I said, about 30,000 have escaped overall. But in the year 2009, about 2,900 refugees escaped. It's about half of that number who are escaping to South Korea now. And that's because of the killing machine of Kim Jong-un has decided he does not want people to escape. Just to say, I mean, as far as like this particular person is missing, that particular person hasn't been seen. Oh, wait, that person is back. Oh, wait, no, that person's gone again. I mean, it doesn't really matter because those characters just come and go. But the main thing is about the killing machine of North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, absolutely. Although it does leave, you know, this once again, some real kind of incongruence where things don't really quite seem to square on that front. Although the point here's the thing too, that this was widely reported in Western media, Fox, CNN, all the big outlets. They had a field day with that, with mm-hmm. You know, every time there's reports, they run with that. If it bleeds, it leads.
Exactly. So that's the thing. I mean, So we know when the media reports on things we know about, we're like, yeah, yeah, that's distorted. And oh, why are they doing that? But somehow when it's about North Korea, it's like, wow, it must be true. You know, I mean, they just do the same sensationalist kind of reporting about North Korea that they do about other things. I mean, they're not going to sit down and have really serious, deep discussions about North Korea because they know the ratings will go in the tank. So obviously it's just the titillating stuff, strange stuff, oddball stories out of North Korea would interest the people in the media.
Right. I'm not sure if you've got actually one of your students there with you at the moment or not, but if it sounds like they've got a bit of a cold and could maybe stand to maybe if you've got some milk candies or maybe a little too much smoking or something going on. I'm not sure. But
no, my co-director, she's been fighting a cold. We share an office.
Oh, I see. Okay. So what else do we got here on the go? We've got, well, I'll tell you what, speaking of projects in North Korea and whatnot, it's really interesting. We've been trying to get clear on this for ages now. In fact, we've even pitched the idea of a documentary. We engaged in a Twitter war with Seth Rogen, if you can believe that. Seth Rogen out of the Hollywood movie star slash, you know, comedian. Regarding this whole business of how he, the movie that he put together, what was it called? Was it The Dictator or?
The Interview, I think you're referring to.
Oh, The Interview, right. That's right. He had a golden opportunity there to actually be, I mean, he's one of Hollywood's biggest potheads. And he had a golden opportunity there, rather than to make a big deal and fiasco and international brouhaha, he could have at that particular moment. And there was, in fact, one scene, I guess, where he was being interrogated by a couple of the secret police or soldiers, you know, what have you, smoking a cigarette. I don't understand why it wasn't a spliff. You know, why he should have been, instead of going to North Korea and trying to assassinate the dear leader, why not, you know... Because here's the thing, maybe you don't understand this maybe, or you haven't heard of this, but apparently North Korea, unlike
the marijuana there, yeah.
The democratic and freedom-loving South, where it's, oh, das ist verboten, yeah? But in the North, this tyrannical oppressive regime, not a problem. You can smoke as much, apparently soldiers and farm workers, they're done with their hard, strenuous day laboring out in the fields. You want to relax? Have a little of the plant, the herb that, you know, maybe the deer leader put it there for people, right, to consume. I don't know. So we'd actually like to put a documentary together, a fact-finding mission. You've got some contacts. There's all kinds of people here in the South with various, you know, range of contacts to one degree or another. So that's one of the projects we'd love to do, though, and really get clear on things, because where do things stand? There's conflicting reports. Wikipedia says it's a blue country, which means it's totally fine. And then others say, oh, no, and so on and so forth. But I'll tell you another thing. For their economy, they talk about their flagging and faltering economy. What a better way of providing economic solutions than setting up an Amsterdam-styled, you know, like a pot and marijuana cafes with coffee and the whole bit. Very relaxing, comfortable. It's a no-brainer, really. But clearly, the vision is there, the means are there, but the political will is lacking.
So, the only thing I'll say about that is that they wouldn't do it because they don't mind foreigners going there for a short time, just like on a tour, but they don't want you to stay. And I mean, I don't know if people would just go there just to have a quick toke.
And then, you have an exclusive tour zone where it's like this area, like a red light district almost, only I'm not sure what the prostitute end of things, but you know, it's to provide an economic boost. Yeah. I don't understand why they're not doing it. To me, it doesn't make sense that on the one hand, you have North Korea, oh, we have no money. We want your support. Send us money. And we're starving. And then at the same time, well, why aren't you pursuing these economic solutions?
I don't follow this issue. So, but I'll just say that they reluctantly allowed the tourism industry to grow. But that was out of necessity. It was not because it's something that they embraced. Because any opening that they have there is a threat to the regime. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they're thinking about opportunities so they can make money. I mean, they're just thinking about how they can maintain control.
At any cost.
Yeah, that's their focus. And then, I mean, again, they do let the tourists come in for a couple of days, you know, ride around on a guided tour and all that. But then it's like, now out you go. And they have all kinds of restrictions on the people who do go there. Even if it can make money, I don't think they they still want to make money in their way. So, yeah.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately, I don't think that your idea will fly with them. But who knows, a couple of years from now, they might be looking for a new way to boost the tourism industry.
Just doing what we can to work on getting the word out there. How difficult do you think it would be in lining something up or securing a travel visa with the stated purposes of going in to put a documentary together? Just a documentary, maybe, I'm not sure if you have to tell a little white lie or a fib or whatnot, or you could be quite honest and have them just shoot you down, or who knows? Yeah,
well, I'll put it like this. Last week I had a visitor from Hong Kong who was taking a group of about 40 high school kids to North Korea, and they're paying about $1,000 per person. So they're going to spend about $40,000. Now, obviously, the North Korean regime is going to tightly control everything about their visit. They talked to us because they also wanted to get, like, a perspective from North Koreans who had already escaped. And basically, I told them that you're idiots because the ones that you meet in North Korea are not going to speak honestly to you. So I mention this because if you do this kind of documentary in North Korea, I don't know how good your Korean is, but obviously it's going to be hard for you to have deep conversations with them, number one. Number two, they're going to think you're a CIA spy.
They've said that about me here in the South. So, I mean, hey, I mean, what can you do? Everyone's a spy.
Yeah. My point is that if you wanted to do a documentary to learn about North Korea, that there are lots of North Korean refugees who escaped and they can speak honestly compared to the North Koreans who are in North Korea who they don't know exactly who you are. They don't know if you're part of some setup to get them to have some negative comments about the regime. So I'm saying that I don't think a documentary there would work very well. A couple of people have done some undercover stuff. Depends on
Vice, of course, yeah, and so
yeah,
on and so
sure.
forth.
Yeah, so
but they've been banned. Yeah. Apparently, they're never allowed to come. They haven't been invited back in.
Yeah. Well, I guess if they get one thing done, it's enough for them. So, but I'm saying there are lots of opportunities here to actually get something done as far as learning about North Korea. Obviously, people want to go directly to North Korea to talk to people who can't speak freely.
I guess one way of doing it in the lead-up to things would be to talk to the North Koreans themselves, as you say, and ask them what's the deal, you know?
Right.
So, Yeon-mi Park, there's a name that's, I guess, one of the last questions here. Did you say that you actually know her? She's become quite famous over the last little while, or...?
Not only do I know her, but if you type in Casey and Yeon-mi, you'll see that she worked with me. I hired her at a company. I used to work at Freedom Factory, number one. Number two, she was the ambassador of TNKR in 2014. And number three, as I say, if you type in Casey and Yeon-mi, you'll see a podcast that we hosted in 2014. That podcast I mentioned earlier.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's why the name, it jumped out at me. It rang a bell. Now, this is, I'm not sure if you've picked up on this or not. In fact, just yesterday, talk about timing, there was a vlog that came out where an independent journalist outfit put together this piece, which really does not make her look that good as far as the stories that she's telling, the way that she's kind of flip-flopping from one set of details to the next.
I'm not going to go into detail about this, but one thing I would say is one problem when I first started working with her, we talked about it. If she tries to do this in English, she has to realize that no one is going to be generous to her, that if she makes any mistakes with her grammar or in telling the stories, the fact that she's doing it in English, they're going to say, she's lying. So my point is that this was a young girl who had been sold when she was 13 years old, and she didn't want to talk about this. And when we started working together, one of the first things she said to me is that I don't want to tell my story. And I said, when you work with me, you never have to tell your story. And if you look at our podcast, we talked about like the growth of markets in North Korea, about adjusting to being in South Korea, about food in North Korea, about good jobs for women in North Korea. But a lot of the media, obviously, what's your story? We want to know your story. And she didn't want to tell it, so she was avoiding getting into detail about her story. And then part of her problem is that her English was improving, but she was in English
actually her third language that she was learning. And so she's trying to tell these things in English and not doing it well in all cases. But middle class jackasses and intellectuals and professors and activists were seizing on, oh, she didn't tell this part of the story right. I mean, she actually had one mistake that she had done with her grammar, and then people were attacking her. And she's like, I don't even understand the point they're making about the grammar. What's the difference between this and that? I don't know what it is. So what I'm saying is that it's a much deeper thing, but people are not going to be generous or understanding that she's trying to explain these things in her third language.
I think the point that they're trying to make here, though, and I understand what you're saying, but that it's more a question of the details, the particulars of her story keep changing.
Right.
It's
not right, but it's better for her to speak on her own behalf. I just told you the part that I observed about the
right.
problem in English. But obviously, everyone needs to speak on their own behalf.
Yeah, not on behalf of TNKR or any other organization,
right. mm-hmm.
obviously. That aside, let's just assume that she's, telling the truth or what have you, just having struggling with language. There have been others, though, apparently, that have defectors, that have kind of apparently stretched
okay.
the truth or fib.
Yeah, and lawyers lie, radio hosts lie, doctors lie, teachers lie, police officers lie. Okay, go ahead.
I'm just looking at this one video that was shared here recently, and there's an escape from Camp 14. Have you heard of the book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know the person. I know. Actually, I moderated a session with him and the author back in 2013.
Well, are the criticisms justified then, or once again, is it just simply
he admitted that he didn't tell the entire story. I mean, the thing is, just as context, please remember this man was born in some type of prison camp. He was not born at some Ivy League institution writing books and things. So apparently his view of the world doesn't go along with others. Perhaps he should not have ever done a book, because he actually wrote, I don't know how much you know of the story, but after he came to South Korea, about a year later, he wrote a book in Korean. After that, he just dropped out, the book didn't do very well. Then later on, he actually was the author of the book actually had to convince him to let him write about him again. And then he just, he just told the story. And then, later on, he finally confessed to him that when he wrote the first book that he hadn't told every single detail. And then later on, it revealed that, maybe he wasn't even born in the other camp. But I'm sorry, I just don't get into this kind of chit-chat stuff and the kind of gossipy stuff.
Yeah, the one last point here, and I think it's a good point dealing with the way the media operates, is that mm-hmm. the sharks that are out there, really, that
right.
it's a big media circus. They're
right.
they're willing, it's the claim here, it's made, they're willing to pay up to $500 an hour to get some inside scoop from purported eyewitnesses out of North Korea and their stories. Have you heard of these exorbitant rates, $500 an hour to sit down and talk to a North Korean for their details of their personal story?
I have no idea about that. Again, this just sounds like, I think you spend a little too much time in the trashy media world.
Me?
Yes. All these kinds of stories.
No, it just came up online. It popped up last night.
Just the kind of trashy kind of media world. And I'm saying, really, I don't get into all these things. Now, is anyone really willing to pay $500 an hour for that? I don't know, but like some celebrities, years ago, I was working with a project, and they wanted to invite, what's the poet's name? I forgot her name now. The one who did I Know Why a Caged Bird Sings. I think she wanted to charge $75,000 for a short speech. The Clintons get paid millions for speeches. And actually, there's one guy in like the North Korea studies field who was also talking about this kind of trashy stuff. I mean, and he makes, I think it's like $250,000 a year at his job talking about these things. I mean, if someone's willing to pay that much money, I mean, you as a libertarian, why should you give a damn?
Well, libertarianism is one thing. The facts are another.
But I'm saying, if somebody wants to pay that amount of money, what's the problem? People single out North Korean refugees like there's some special, just alien group of people. A lot of people pay lots of money for lots of things. I mean, for speeches for just 20 minutes, people will pay $20,000-$50,000, depending on who the person is. So I'm just saying that there might be some, and again, I'm not in this. I don't know. That's probably like half of our budget. So it's not related to us, this kind of thing. So this is a whole different world. I'm not involved in it. No one's paying me that amount of money. No one's ever offered me that kind of thing. Probably no one ever will. But if you talk about it, just if you talk about it, that somebody, a reporter, wanted to pay money. Now, first of all,
these would be book deals. And as you say, like the big kind of like the TED Talks and the high, well, more
TED
high.
Talks, people don't get paid for the TED Talks. And then for book deals, I mean, lots of people out there get lots of money for book deals after they become prominent. I mean, you're not just talking about North Korean refugees, but you're talking about people. I mean, politicians, actors, actresses, athletes. Again, they'll get paid lots of money. When Dennis Rodman, speaking of Dennis Rodman, I believe if you check, he's written about 8 books. How much money do you think he got in advance for those books?
No idea.
Probably got some money. Probably more than $5,000 or whatever it is you're talking about for these.
Usually, sure.
Yeah. So I'm saying that. So I'm just saying that in this world, different people, for whatever reason, attract attention. And then some people want to pay them. Now, most of the times, it's just nonsense to me.
Yeah, the propaganda value would be the main reason, I suppose, that people would be willing to throw that sort of money at, you know, and to offer them those sort of deals. Did Valkyrie, did we
people.
Just hear you?
Well, I'm saying that you might want to focus on refugees. I'm saying people are doing this. I mean, all kinds of people get paid all kinds of money for these kinds of speeches and books and all that.
Yeah, caveat emptor, I guess, obviously. Valkyrie, just want to quickly jump in. We're wrapping things up here with Casey. You had a quick little interjection or something you'd like to add to things here?
Well, I wanted Valkyrie. To clarify on why people would pay and do pay so much for North Korean cases, because it is so completely socially, economically, and politically cut off that Western people want to feed on their fantasies and their beliefs that North Korea is this horrible, evil location. So they will pay $500 for a single interview. And if the person... Now, these people might be cut off socially, but they understand the meaning of income and how to earn a quick buck. And if you wrap up your story or embellish it in a certain way, you can easily earn up to $750 an hour for an interview. It's immaculate how it is. And it's not trashy media. It's just knowing that people
Wait, do you
are
know
so any- upset
hold
with
on,
evil.
Hold on. Do you actually know anything about this, or is this just conjecture on your part?
For case for case, I wouldn't know, but as
yeah,
a...
Yeah, you don't know. Okay, I'm just clear. You don't actually know.
No, if I yeah, may... No, okay, if okay, I may...
Okay. Yeah, you don't know, but it's just conjecture.
As a business and marketing student and someone who has studied Nazi Germany, there were plenty of cases in Nazi Germany where Jewish people would embellish and lie about stories to earn money. So why would someone from North Korea be any different?
I know that, yeah, but what?
Good point.
So many people write books. You don't think they embellish things?
There's a difference between a fiction novel.
This is just a common thing.
I think there's a difference between a fiction novel embellishing and a non-fiction model, which is what they're doing.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Are you, you're addressing talking to Valkyrie, or I'm not sure what.
Yeah, no, I'm just finished with this point. I'm saying this is just the kind of gossipy world. Look, I'm trying to run an organization. I'm trying to help North Korean refugees improve themselves. I'm not into this gossipy stuff.
That's why we had you on the show, was to talk about it and have an open, honest discussion.
Yeah. But I'm saying not this gossipy stuff that you're finishing with.
Well, you've got to, these are the serious issues that have to be addressed. We can't
I'm saying I don't focus on these things. I'm not interested in these things.
Well, they shouldn't be focused on, but they do need to be addressed and then move on to the next
point. Yeah, by you, but not by me.
So you're saying that you just rather completely ignore the fact that this even occurs?
No. I'm saying that I'm focused on building an organization to help North Korean refugees adjust.
Which is great, and that's why we invited you on the show and have wanted to have this discussion. So, we've gone a little bit over time, actually. It's kind of interesting with, I'm not sure how many hardball questions there actually were over the course of our conversation. I think maybe one, but I enjoyed myself. I know, and hopefully our listeners will as well as we stream things out here this Saturday. You're going to be at a TESOL conference on Saturday afternoon. Is that right?
Right. So March 25th, I'll be speaking at the TESOL conference, along with a North Korean refugee who was an English teacher in North Korea. And she'll be talking about her story, being an English teacher there and about adjusting here. And my co-director, Eun-gu Lee, will also be speaking on the panel. Hanyang University.
I'm sorry, which university?
At Hanyang University. It'll be the Co-TESOL Conference.
And as far as your main links, ones that you'd like us to include in the show notes, we've got your main Facebook, of course, the Teach NK Refugees, a couple Korea Times articles, ones... Mm-hmm. Stories you've put together, highlighting your column as you've pointed out, and there's a donation. I think it's a tnkr.networkforgood.com project.
Yeah, although actually a better one is the one I mentioned earlier: give.teachnorthkoreanrefugees.org.
Okay, well, we'll be sure to include that in the notes as well. So. Thanks so much for taking the time out to have the conversation. A lot of ground covered, a lot of enlightening, insightful information and conversation. I think that about covers it. Casey, happy sailing. All the best.
Okay, thanks so much.
Ahoy. As listeners may have already guessed, that about does it for this week's episode of Pirate Radio Podcasts, Fireworks, and All. Feel free to join us in the Rogues Gallery After Show as we gather for even more free-flowing conversation, spirited dialogue, and feisty analysis. If you've been a regular listener, enjoying the content we've produced over the last year, be sure to drop by our Patreon page and lend a little support. For the same price as a cup of coffee, you can help keep the Robin Hood sailing smoothly along each month. With a new account up in place for just a few weeks now, Kelly Freeman recently became our first official patron, pledging a whole $5 per episode. And that's only because he's a super generous guy. For as little as a dollar a week, you'll win access to our regular behind-the-scenes premium content. Upcoming shows include a return visit next week from occult author and researcher William Ramsey. Hollywood muckraker Mark Ebner is also scheduled to join us mid-April to discuss the mysterious death of Kung Fu star David Carradine and all things Scientology. Shows featuring renowned Canadian ufologist Grant Cameron and a second edition of our very own in-house World Minds Indie Music Showcase are also well in the works. If you yourself have an intriguing idea for a guest or story, either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or shoot us a quick email via pirateoneradio@gmail.com. Finally, don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow any of our social media channels via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google Plus, or Minds.com. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, this has been episode 54 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, Ship's Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tally-ho.